pressure to develop the hydrogen bomb increased. Hawks in the US administration, including General Curtis Old Iron Pants LeMay of the US Air Force, had urged hitting the Soviets with atomic bombs before they built their own to ensure American global hegemony. Now, any attack would invite an equally devastating response. The fragile, terrifying era of mutually assured destruction was underway. Spies like Ursula Burton and Klaus Fuchs claimed to be safeguarding military equilibrium by stealing nuclear secrets from one side to give to the other. They believed they were making the world safer while making communism stronger. Inside MI5, the Ursula Burton case remained open. Every few months, a desultory discussion took place about whether to send investigators back to the Furs. Ursula Burton should be reinterrogated, wrote Colonel James Robertson of the counter-espionage branch. I believe individuals of this type ought to be interrogated repeatedly until it is established beyond doubt that nothing more can be extracted from them. But Skardon was disinclined to bother. I have given considerable thought to the possibility of reinterrogating Ursula Burton. Nothing has arisen recently to make such an effort likely to be more productive, and as it is impossible to assume a successful outcome, I do not feel disposed to reopen the matter. It was agreed that the best thing to do about Mrs. Burton was nothing at all. She has been interrogated with no result and is a very tough nut. The winter of 1949 was bitterly cold. Len skidded off his motorbike and badly broke an arm and a leg. The doctor said he would be off work for at least 8 months. The aluminium factory took the opportunity to sack him. Her small legacy from her father was running out. Len sank deeper into depression. Nina's pet mouse froze to death on the windowsill of the Furs. The water pipes burst. Bored, baffled by the GRU's continued silence, uncertain of the future, Ursula found her espionage career was in deep freeze. One morning in late January, more out of habit than hope, Ursula cycled yet again to the dead drop site. The road was icy and treacherous as she followed the familiar route, under the railway and past the crossroads. She leaned her bike against the fourth tree and reached into the route. Her hand closed around a small package. With freezing fingers, she tore it open. Cash, and a letter from the centre granting permission for her to go to Germany. After 3 years, Sonia had come in from the cold. Ursula was keen to see her homeland again, but not certain she wished to live there. Michael, now nearly 19 years old, was in his second year of university in Scotland. Even if Len agreed to leave, he could not travel with his leg in plaster. She made unhurried preparations for a holiday in Berlin. Visa restrictions had now been relaxed, and she was told there would be little problem obtaining the necessary permit. There was no hurry. She had evaded the Chinese and Japanese secret police, the Swiss security service, and the Gestapo. There was little to fear from the plodding Mr. Snedden and his sad moustache. MI5 clearly knew nothing of her recent espionage. On the 3rd of February, 1950, Ursula picked up the newspaper from the doorstep of the Furs and felt a lurch of shock and sorrow as she read the front page headline. German atomic scientist arrested. Klaus Fuchs, the scientist who gave Russia the bomb, had been caught. 4 years earlier, Fuchs had returned from the US to take up a post as head of theoretical physics at the UK Atomic Energy Research Establishment at Harwell in Oxfordshire, where scientists were designing a nuclear reactor to produce energy for civilian use. A second, secret agenda was the production of plutonium for making atomic weapons independently of the US. Fuchs was a pivotal member of the team. As a GRU officer, Ursula was unaware of his return, for Fuchs was now a KGB asset. For a time, he eschewed spying, but after a year back in Britain, he received instructions to meet a KGB contact, Alexander Feklisov, in the Nag's Head pub in Wood Green, North London, carrying a copy of the Tribune. The contact, holding a red book, would bring over a beer and say, "Stout is not so good, I prefer lager," to which Fuchs should reply, "I think Guinness is best." From then on, every few months, Fuchs met Feklisov at various London pubs. Over Guinness and lager, he handed over a fresh trove of secret scientific intelligence. Britain's atomic bomb planning, the construction of experimental reactors, pages of notes on plutonium production, and precise calculations of the nuclear tests that would enable Soviet scientists to assess the Western nuclear stockpile. He also described key features of the hydrogen bomb being developed in the US, information that prompted the Soviet Union to work on its own superbomb. Fuchs's KGB handlers went overboard with the spycraft. If he needed an emergency rendezvous, for example, he was required to throw a copy of the soft porn magazine Men Only over a garden wall in Kew, on the corner of Stanmore and Kew Roads, between the third and fourth trees, and write a message on the 10th page, then place a chalk mark on the fence on the north side of Holmesdale Road opposite a tree at the eastern end of the road, which would indicate to the occupier of the house in Stanmore Road that there was something for him in the garden. It would have been easier to memorise the formulae for plutonium production. Fuchs had been scrupulous in following the rules. He made no mistakes. Another routine MI5 review of his record uncovered nothing incriminating. Fuchs was brought down because a breakthrough by American cryptographers allowed the decoding, at least partially, of thousands of wartime messages sent by the KGB and GRU. The spy hunters could peer back into the past. The historical wireless traffic, codenamed Venona, revealed that the Soviets had deployed a senior mole inside the Manhattan Project. And by July 1949, the month before the first Soviet bomb test, British and American investigators had concluded that the spy must be Klaus Fuchs. The Venona traffic was too secret to be revealed in court. Tapping Fuchs's phone, intercepting his letters, and intense surveillance produced nothing. The only way to get a conviction would be to extract a confession. MI5 sent in Jim Scarden. By this time, Fuchs had been a spy for 8 years, and the strain was telling. He had come to admire Britain greatly. At exactly the moment MI5 picked up the scent, he broke off contact with his Soviet handler. On the 21st of December 1949, Scarden confronted Fuchs in his office at Harwell. He used the same blunt approach he had attempted with Ursula. "I am in possession of precise information which shows you have been guilty of espionage on behalf of the Soviet Union." Fuchs thought for a moment and replied ambiguously, "I don't think so. Perhaps you will tell me what the evidence is?" Since the MI5 sleuth was not privy to Venona, Scarden could not. After 4 hours, the interrogator had got nowhere and was uncertain of Fuchs's guilt. After a second interview, he decided he was innocent. A third was inconclusive. Scarden was maintaining his unfailing capacity to miss the spy under his very nose. But on the 23rd of January 1950, Fuchs asked Mr. Snedden to come to his home in Harwell. "He was obviously under considerable mental stress," Scarden wrote. "I suggested that he should unburden his mind and clear his conscience by telling me the full story." Fuchs demurred, and instead of pressing home his advantage, Scarden suggested they break off and have lunch in a pub. During the meal, he seemed to be resolving the matter and to be considerably abstracted. By the time they got back to the house, Fuchs had made up his mind. He said that he had decided it would be in his best interests to answer my questions. This breakthrough would later be cited as evidence of Scarden's genius as an interrogator. In fact, Fuchs simply decided to tell all with no further prompting. Indeed, Skardon was astonished when Fuchs confessed that he had spent the previous 8 years spying for the Soviet Union, passing information relating to atomic energy at irregular but frequent meetings. 3 days later, Fuchs signed a 10-page confession in room 055 of the War Office. Like Fuchs's espionage, his decision to confess was framed as an act of principle, with an echo from his father's pulpit. There are certain standards of moral behaviour which are in you and that you cannot disregard. I still believe in communism, but not as it is practiced in Russia today. Fuchs naively believed that, having got the truth off his chest, he would be allowed to continue working at Harwell. He was shocked to be taken into custody. The arrest of Klaus Fuchs made the front pages of every newspaper in Britain, including Ursula's Oxford Times. She felt a chill of pure fear as she continued reading. The German scientist had passed atomic secrets to Moscow by meeting a foreign woman with black hair in Banbury. Even the inept Mr. Snedden surely could not miss so obvious a clue. Ursula was now in greater danger than at any time since Olga Moot's betrayal. In urgent conclave with Len, she discussed the implications of Fuchs's arrest. Since Detective Constable Herbert of Chipping Norton had not yet turned up with an arrest warrant, Fuchs had probably not revealed her name. Perhaps he did not know it. "I had never been in his house, nor he in mine," she wrote. "I had never spent the night in Birmingham, where he worked, so that no hotel registration could be found. Fuchs may not have betrayed her yet, but he had plainly divulged some details of their meetings, and under oath in a courtroom, he would surely reveal more. In the meantime, MI5 would be assembling clues. I expected my arrest any day." The Fuchs trial was due to open on the 28th of February. Mr. Snedden would be coming for her very soon. But getting out of Britain would not be easy. Obtaining a German visa would take at least 10 days if MI5 did not block it. She told the two younger children they were going on holiday. In Aberdeen, Michael was unaware that his mother was preparing to defect to East Germany. Len would have to stay behind and join them when his leg healed, if he was not in prison. A year earlier, to bring in some extra cash, Ursula had started letting the spare room to a young couple, Geoffrey and Madeline Greathead. Geoffrey was a farm worker, while Madeline worked as a cleaner in the home of the local squire. Mrs. Greathead was a cheerful presence in the house, but extremely inquisitive. That February, she noticed Ursula seemed particularly harassed and had burned a large pile of papers in the yard. "We were never allowed into the cellar. She would ask me if I minded looking after the children when she went to London, which she quite often did." Madeline loved to gossip. "We began to feel suspicious. We would talk about our suspicions, but folk would look at you as if it was all made up." Madeline liked Ursula. She showed me how to make ice cream and sponge cakes, but she sensed that there was something strange afoot and decided to keep an eye on her landlady and find out what she was up to. Ursula had spent the previous 20 years on the alert for signs of surveillance. She immediately realized that Madeline's questions were more than idle curiosity. Once again, she was living with a spy under her own roof. She bought 3 air tickets to Hamburg. In 4 large American kit bags, she packed clothes and supplies for herself and the children. Her arrangements recalled the moment 20 years earlier when she had assembled an escape kit for herself and baby Michael in Shanghai and awaited a signal from Richard Sorge to flee for the communist-held Chinese interior. Her nerves stretched to snapping point. She scanned the fields of Great Rollright for signs of MI5's watchers. Skardon, meanwhile, was slowly and methodically grilling Fuchs in his cell in Brixton Prison. The extent of his espionage in both the UK and the US shocked intelligence chiefs on both sides of the Atlantic. Fuchs did not deny giving the Soviet Union the atomic bomb. But like Foote before him, he did not tell MI5 everything. On the 8th of February, 2 days before Fuchs was formally arraigned on charges of violating the Official Secrets Act, Skadden laid out dozens of photographs of individuals who had been known to have been or suspected of being engaged in intelligence activities in the UK, and asked Fuchs if he could identify any of them. One was a photo of Ursula Burton. Fuchs put several pictures to one side, murmuring that the face seemed familiar, but he skipped over the photo of Ursula, as he did over those of Jürgen Kaczynski and Hans Kahler. 6 days later, Skadden was back, pressing Fuchs for more details of his Soviet handlers. The second contact, Skadden duly recorded, was a woman whom Fuchs met in a country lane near Banbury, Oxfordshire. This woman was, in his opinion, an alien, although she spoke good English, this being the language in which his espionage transactions were carried out. He has described her as a short, unprepossessing woman in her middle 30s. Although Fuchs has been shown a large number of possible photographs, he has been unable to identify any of them as that of the woman in question. MI5's failure to make the obvious connection to Ursula Burton was, with hindsight, a counterintelligence blunder of historic proportions. Fuchs had admitted meeting a foreign, female Soviet spy in Banbury. A few months earlier, Jim Skadden had interrogated a foreign, female Soviet spy just 10 miles away in Great Rollright. Indeed, there was only one foreign, female Soviet spy on MI5's radar. And yet it concluded, "Without further information, it seems improbable that this contact will be identified." On the 18th of February, Ursula's application for a permit to visit friends in Germany was returned by the Foreign Office, stamped "No objection." The first major hurdle had been cleared. But her name was on the MI5 watch list. Sooner or later, a very loud alarm bell would sound inside the security service, a notice would be sent to all airports, and the door would slam shut. How long that might take was a matter of guesswork. The wheels of British bureaucracy tend to turn slowly, or at least unpredictably. Village gossip, by contrast, can travel with almost magical speed. The children were talking openly about the holiday they were taking, in the middle of school term. What kind of housewife goes abroad, leaving her husband to fend for himself with a broken leg? 4 big kit bags seemed a lot of luggage for a woman and 2 children going on a short vacation. Word of the strange goings-on at the Firs might already have reached the lounge bar of the Unicorn. From there it could travel almost instantly to the ears of Detective Constable Herbert. Madeline Greathead was taking a close interest in Ursula's travel plans and asking a lot of questions. Ursula resolved to divert the lodger's attention and use her to spread some disinformation. One day Ursula asked me if I could help her with some pressing, as she was returning to Germany the next day to claim her father's estate. With the nosy lodger out of the way, attending to a mountain of washing and ironing, Ursula made her final preparations. She extracted the transmitter from the cellar, wrapped it in sacking, and buried it in the undergrowth. Today, somewhere in Great Rollright Woods, lies a rusting, homemade shortwave radio, a spy's buried legacy. Then she carefully packed up the few mementos she would take with her, the Chinese prints from Shanghai, a postcard from Switzerland, and a framed photograph of Richard Sorge. Finally, she climbed on her bicycle and rode towards Banbury, performing the usual counter-surveillance routine, doubling back twice to ensure she was not being followed. At the hollow tree route beyond the crossing, she inserted a message for the GRU, explaining that she was quitting her post and slipping away to Berlin. Then Agent Sonia cycled home for the last time. The following afternoon, Len loaded the kit bags into the boot of the Chipping Norton taxi. Ursula embraced him tightly, wondering once more if she would ever see him again. Farewell or goodbye. we did not know which it would be. Nina and Peter were fizzing with excitement at the prospect of riding on an aeroplane. They hugged Mrs. Greathead and Penny the cat, climbed into the back seat, and waved to Len through the back window until he disappeared from view. As she waited on the hard benches in the departure lounge of London Airport, now Heathrow, the children happily played poker dice at her feet. Ursula stared rigidly at the doors, a bubble of anxiety steadily rising in her stomach. At any moment, the police must surely burst in and arrest her. The trial of Klaus Fuchs would begin the next day, and he had probably already identified the girl from Banbury. Even now, Detective Constable Herbert, alerted by the suspicious Mrs. Greathead, might be picking up the telephone to MI5. Britain had adopted her, and now she was fleeing the land she had come to love. The next few minutes would decide whether she disappeared to a country she no longer knew or spent the next decade or more in a British prison, condemned as a notorious communist spy. She resolved to say nothing if she was arrested, admit nothing. She would maintain the discipline of a trained Soviet intelligence officer. Colonel Kaczynski would not crack. But what would Michael do when his mother's face was splashed across every newspaper? If she and Len were convicted, what would become of the children? She scanned the crowd for a man in a trilby, flanked by policemen, approaching with a smile of triumph beneath his weak moustache. But Mr. Snedden never appeared. The air hostess welcomed them aboard, more concerned with a group of inebriated Italian football fans than the innocuous woman holding tight to the hands of her two chattering children. From the window seat, Ursula gazed out on the rain-spattered runway, where a military plane was taxiing for takeoff. Instinctively, she memorized its markings. Then the door closed on England for the last time. On the 27th of February 1950, Ursula and her children flew to Germany. She would not return for another 40 years. Chapter 24. Ruth Werner. On the 1st of March 1950, after a trial lasting 90 minutes, Klaus Fuchs was found guilty of communicating information to a potential enemy and given the maximum sentence of 14 years. Jim Scarden visited him in HM Prison Stafford a few months later and handed over a photograph of a woman with a very untidy mop of hair. Ursula's unladylike scruffiness never ceased to irk him. In placing the photograph of Ursula Burton before Fuchs, I said to him, "This is a photograph which I've already shown you earlier," and he immediately said, "That is the woman at Banbury." He had no doubt that she is the contact, but is unable to say why he failed to identify her when the photograph was placed before him on the previous occasion. Ursula was beyond Mr. Snedden's grasp. The spy hunters refused to believe she had gone. MI5 chief Sir Percy Sillitoe wrote to Colonel Rutherford of the Oxford police, "I'm anxious to establish the present whereabouts of Ursula Burton. She intended to visit friends in Berlin, and it is of course possible that she has not returned." Detective Herbert of Chipping Norton reported that the Furs now stood empty, all the furniture had been sold, and Len Burton had disappeared. To add to MI5's discomfort, confirmation of Ursula's escape came from the FBI. John Simperman wrote an angry note to John Marriott. "Some time ago you were asked to have her interviewed, but it was not deemed desirable. Information has now been received to the effect that Ursula Burton has left England to return to Germany." Far too late, MI5 instructed Border Control to intercept Ursula if she entered or left Britain. Subject is an active communist and is connected with persons engaged in espionage on behalf of a foreign power. Black hair, brown eyes, last known location, Berlin. Occupation, housewife. Embarrassed by its failure to seize Ursula in time, MI5 later propagated a myth that she had bolted back to Germany in 1947. Dick White, the head of MI5, told his biographer that she had fled 2 days after the interview with Scarden, knowing full well she had remained in the UK for another 2.5 years. The East Berlin that Ursula returned to in February 1950 was a city mutilated by war, with piles of rubble in the streets and the blackened hulks of burned-out buildings. There were no hotel rooms available. After just a few days, the children were asking to return to Great Rollright and wondering where Len was. Nina missed Penny the cat. Peter wanted his dinky toys. Jürgen had informed the Soviet authorities of Ursula's arrival. He told her to be patient. She moved into a cold, one-room apartment with her children and waited for the centre to make contact. I lived in isolation. She enrolled the children in the nearest school. Speaking little German, they were teased mercilessly. During the long days, she wandered the city and pondered all that had happened to her. After the intense drama of the escape from Britain, it was as if she had arrived in a grey half-world, populated by people who had managed to survive and nothing more. Jürgen was far too busy to help her settle in. There was little to eat and nothing to do. Yet for the first time in 2 decades, she did not feel stalked. She had no radio transmitter to hide, no agents to contact, no need to conceal her politics. Ursula experienced a sensation she had never known before, and at first did not recognise. She felt a sort of peace. Finally, in May, word came via Jürgen that the centre was sending an emissary. A GRU officer she did not know arrived at her door in civilian clothes and announced, rather stiffly, that he was taking her out for a festive meal. The officer was friendly, but formal. He congratulated her on her work in China, Poland, Switzerland, and Britain, and apologised for the confusion over the dead drop site in Oxfordshire that had interrupted contact for so long. The world was changing fast, he explained. Comrade Stalin had warned that the capitalist West was building nuclear weapons for an attack on the Soviet Union. War was looming on the Korean Peninsula. The GRU would play a vital role in the coming conflict, and there was important work to be done. When would Ursula be ready to resume her work for Soviet military intelligence? Ursula pushed away her plate, took a deep breath, and explained that she no longer wished to be a spy. The man from Moscow was speechless. Looking back, Ursula could not pinpoint the moment she decided to renounce espionage. Perhaps it was Fuchs's arrest, or during the long months when the centre had left her adrift. Or perhaps it was the moment she fled Britain. Over the last 4 months in Berlin, lonely but unafraid, she had tasted tranquility, the calm that comes from laying down arms, an armistice of the soul. The GRU officer tried to change her mind, but she was adamant. I wanted to live as a citizen. I told him that nothing had altered my commitment to the Soviet Union and the work I had done, but that my nerves and powers of concentration were no longer as good as they had been. I felt that 20 years were enough. The profession of Soviet spy is not an easy one to resign from. The GRU was a difficult club to join, and an even harder one to leave. Intelligence officers tended to depart the service when they were old, disgraced, or dead. Early retirement was not in the contract, and anyone attempting to quit was considered a potential traitor. 20 years earlier, Sergei had darkly warned Ursula what would happen to her if she ever tried to back out. She had taken many risks for the Red Army, but the bravest of all was her determination to quit it. Ursula had made up her mind. I stood by my decision. And the centre let her go. Just as she had survived the purges unscathed, so the GRU allowed her to leave its ranks in a way that no other officer would have been permitted to do. Stalin's power was founded on abject obedience. But Ursula, as in so much else, was an exception to the rule. It was a mark of her prestige that she walked away from the spying business without recrimination, reprisal, or regret. Ursula was given a job putting out propaganda for the press department of the East German government. She wrote daily press releases and edited the fortnightly Bulletin Against American Imperialism. Her boss was Gerhard Eisler, the ideological enforcer who had spied on her during her initial recruitment in Shanghai and insisted she should wear a hat. Once again, the children adapted to a wholly new life. Nina abandoned her obsession with the British royal family and joined the Free German Youth. Peter swiftly exchanged his rural-accented English for Berlin slang. As soon as his leg healed, Len Burton flew to Berlin, arriving in June 1950. MI5 did not try to stop him. He was employed by the East German State News Service. After leaving Aberdeen a year later, Michael, an idealistic young socialist, also settled in communist East Germany. The family was reunited. East Germany was a surveillance state, where citizens were encouraged, bribed, or forced to spy on one another. The Ministry of State Security, or Stasi, was one of the most efficient and repressive secret police forces in history, with a vast network of informers. Everyone was spied upon, and Ursula was no exception. The initial Stasi reports on Ursula were positive, noting that she had spent 20 years abroad carrying out confidential work for the party. Her character was described as modest and self-effacing. She is open, honest, and reliable. But like everyone returning from the West, particularly Jews and anyone implicated in intelligence, an odour of suspicion hung over her. Everyone who had been in exile in a capitalist country was deemed untrustworthy, she wrote. The Stasi demanded to know about her interrogation by MI5, the recruitment of Alexander Foote, and, oddly, Marie Ginsburg, the secretary at the League of Nations in Geneva, who had helped her obtain a fake passport. Ginsburg was suspected of links to a US Zionist espionage organization. The Stasi noted disapprovingly that Ursula comes from a bourgeois family background. She was summoned to testify before the Central Party Control Commission. A confidential Stasi report described her as too independent-minded. She has still not overcome all her petit bourgeois tendencies, among which an individualist attitude is revealed. Ursula had made a career out of evading surveillance, and she chafed at the unremitting scrutiny of the state. She even wrote to Erich Mielke, the fearsome Stasi chief, protesting that her neighbours were being quizzed about her political reliability. At one of the houses, the parents were not at home, so they asked the 18-year-old daughter to pass judgment on my trustworthiness and behaviour. She told Mielke, "Tell your officers to refrain from such snooping." She received an apology, but the surveillance continued. With anti-Semitic spy hysteria rising in East Germany, British intelligence spotted an opportunity. If the regime carried out a purge of Jewish communists, then Ursula Burton and Jürgen Kaczynski would be targets. MI5 came up with a plan to try to recruit them, or at least persuade both to redefect to the UK. On the 23rd of January 1953, Colonel Robertson sent a note to MI6, suggesting that Ursula and Jürgen be offered a deal, safe haven in Britain and immunity from prosecution in exchange for their cooperation. These persons are likely to possess valuable information about Russian espionage, and it is worth going to considerable lengths to get them, and with them, their information. We recognise that however alarmed these people may be by the uncertainty of their future under communist regimes, this might be outweighed by fear of legal or other punitive action on the part of the British authorities. Do whatever possible to let it become known to them that they have no fears on that particular score. It is unclear whether this offer was made, or how Ursula and Jürgen responded to it, since MI6 files remain closed. In late 1953, Ursula was officially reprimanded for leaving confidential documents on her desk instead of locking them in a safe. For someone who had hidden world-changing secrets for decades, there was a rich irony in being told that she had committed a gross breach of trust by leaving out an innocuous press release. She resigned, moved briefly to a post in the Foreign Ministry, and then stopped working for the state altogether. But Ursula's life had one more surprising chapter. In 1956, she became a full-time writer, adopting yet another name, a new vocation, and a fresh identity. Henceforth, she would be Ruth Vellner, novelist. Ursula had written from earliest childhood, channeling a vivid imagination into her stories of romance and adventure. Spies and novelists are not so very different. Each conjures up an imagined world and attempts to lure others into it. Some of the greatest writers of the 20th century were also spies, including Graham Greene, Somerset Maugham, Ian Fleming, and John le Carré. In many ways, Ursula's life had been a fiction, presenting one sort of person to the world while being someone else in reality. As Ruth Vellner, she became, once again, another person. Ursula went on to write 14 books, mostly stories for children and young adults. These were labelled as fiction, but they were richly autobiographical, depicting her experiences as a young communist in Berlin, her love affairs, her life in China and Switzerland. The writing was partly a ruse to circumvent the East German censors and write about her secret life, but they also fed an inner compulsion. She had always seen herself as the central character in her own rolling drama. She was a natural thriller writer, in life and on paper. Ursula was careful to disguise identities, but these tales were, in essence, true, beautifully written and closely observed descriptions of an adventurous, incident-packed life. They sold extremely well. Several were bestsellers. Vellner has been described, with only slight exaggeration, as East Germany's Enid Blyton. Ursula became far more famous as Ruth Vellner, a pseudonym picked at random, than she would ever be under her own name. In 1956, 3 years after Stalin's death, he was denounced by his successor, Nikita Khrushchev, and the truth about the full horror of the purges began to emerge. Ursula was appalled and furious to learn about Stalin's crimes and the extent of the criminal butchery. "I lost so many friends," she wrote. Back in 1937 in Moscow, she had known that innocent men and women were being murdered, including many of those closest to her, but she had not protested. To have done so would have been suicidal. Like millions of others, she had looked away and got on with her job. She suffered survivor's guilt. "Why was I left unscathed? I don't know. Perhaps because the choice of so-called guilty ones was a matter of chance." The year that Ursula switched career and changed her name, Rudolf Hamburger finally emerged from the gulag. For 10 years, Rudy took notes and drew sketches, recording his hunger, exhaustion, cold, boredom, and love as one of 1.5 million prisoners in the Soviet labor system. In Karaganda camp on the Kazakh steppes, Rudy met Fatima, an Iranian woman imprisoned after an unauthorized Muslim meeting in her home. She worked in the kitchens. They made love in the store's hut. "In the hasty pleasure of love, we can forget the inhumanity of our long exile," he wrote. Fatima got pregnant and aborted the child. Soon after, Rudy was moved again. She cries and her black, wet eyes accompany me until the gate is far behind me. "Is there still happiness, peace, humanity somewhere in the world?" he wondered. Transferred to a lumber camp in the foothills of the Urals, but too weak for forestry work, the once promising architect performed routine building maintenance. "It all appalls me," he wrote. the insignificant tasks I am set, the barracks and barbed wire to prevent me from forgetting where I am, the hunger and the bugs. What do I have to look forward to if I do survive through to freedom? Starved, bitten by beasts, grey-haired, a creature alienated from life and work. But Fatima was right. Do not give up. To give up is death. A fellow inmate received 4 kilos of sugar from home, sat on his bed, consumed it in a single sitting, and immediately died. Suicide by sugar. In 1951, Rudy was transferred to yet another camp, whose inmates were constructing the world's largest hydroelectric power plant. And then back to the dreaded Urals. In 1953, Rudolf Hamburger was formally released into an alternative captivity. He could not leave the Soviet Union. "Where do you want to go?" he was asked. He had no passport, and only his discharge papers to identify himself. "What do I know of this country after 9.5 years of hermetic seclusion? I am like a blind man, asked if he wants his room painted red or blue." He wound up in the small Ukrainian city of Milarovo, managing a construction site. By now, Ursula and others knew of his whereabouts and were lobbying for his return to Germany, but Rudy did not fit into the defined bureaucratic categories, being neither a prisoner of war nor a refugee from Nazi Germany. It would take another 2 years before the paperwork was completed. Finally, in July 1955, Rudy Hamburger returned to Berlin. Ursula had told her children he was coming back after a long stay in the Soviet Union. Michael had last seen his father 16 years earlier. Ursula also took this opportunity to explain to her daughter that her father was not Rudy, as she always believed, but a Lithuanian sailor she knew nothing about. Nina responded primly, "Mummy, I am not at all happy that you had so many men." Rudy had been damaged by a decade of captivity, but not destroyed. "It was not a broken man that I met, but he had changed from the picture I had of him," Ursula wrote. "Graying, slightly bowed, a brittle voice and dazed, like a man emerging from a cellar into the light, a semi-stranger with a smile that hid a touch of melancholy. His politics unchanged, Hamburger joined the communist-dominated ruling Socialist Unity Party. Perhaps we will develop in the future a completely new, unprecedented type of human being, a man born of the new economic system," he wrote. He settled in Dresden, where he was employed as an architect by the city council. Rudy never spoke of his experiences in the camps, remarking only, and in a way accurately, that he had worked on Soviet construction sites. Michael did not discover his father had been in the Gulag until the 1970s. In 1958, Rudy Hamburger was recruited as a Stasi informant, with the codename Karl Winkler. His task as one of the Stasi's 170,000 snoopers was to report on his colleagues. He refused to collect and pass on compromising material, but his work for the Stasi was rated good. Rudolf Hamburger had been brutally mistreated by the communist espionage system, and he ended up working for it. Rudy and Ursula's son, Michael Hamburger, became one of Germany's leading Shakespeare scholars. For 30 years, he worked as dramaturge and director at the Deutsches Theater in Berlin. Nina Hamburger was a teacher. Peter Burton, the youngest, became a distinguished biologist-philosopher at the Academy of Sciences in East Berlin. Ursula's children idolized her, did not entirely trust her, and wondered how well they really knew her. "I do not think my mother had us children as cover for her spy work," said Nina in later life. It was more a question than a statement. Looking back, Peter reflected on the dual, competing drives in his mother's life. There were two important things to her children and the communist cause. I don't know what she would have done if she had had to choose between them. Ursula's younger son resented the way his mother had seemed to dig out her children's secrets. She always asked two questions too many. She always wanted to know a little more than I wanted to tell. There was always a tension. My sister told her everything. My brother told her nothing and kept his secrets hidden. For Michael in particular, an extraordinary childhood left deep scars. The father he adored had disappeared inexplicably for most of his youth. His mother was not the person she had seemed. The knowledge that she had risked her children for her cause haunted him. She did what she did out of conviction for the liberation of mankind, and I am proud of her for that. But if she had been caught in Poland, I would have been packed off to an orphanage, or worse. That thought still gives me tremors. By the age of 10, he had lived in 6 different countries and more than a dozen homes. The family life Michael remembered with such poignancy had been riddled with secrets. "I have been married and divorced 3 times," Michael Hamburger said at the age of 88. "Perhaps I never really learned to trust anyone." He died in January 2020, soon after reading the manuscript of this book. In 1966, another of Ursula's lovers lurched back into her life. Johann Patra was now living in Brazil with his wife and son, working as an electrical engineer and growing vegetables on a small farm. "As you know, I've never been interested in material wealth," he wrote to her. He spoke of emigrating to East Germany. Ursula invited him to visit, but warned that he might find it hard to adapt. The following January, a gaunt, trembling figure she hardly recognized appeared at the door. He was close to a breakdown. He could not speak. Nor, for that matter, could I. When Johann had recovered his composure, he described his life. The center had never re-established contact with him in China, but he had maintained links with the communists and discovered the fate of the Mukden network. Shushin was killed. She didn't betray anyone. Her husband was arrested a little later. I don't know what they did to him, but he lost his mind and is supposed to have confessed. No one knew what had become of their children. In 1949, with the final defeat of Chiang Kai-shek's nationalists and the founding of the People's Republic, all foreigners had been forced to leave China. He felt homesick for Europe. They talked for hours, but Ursula sensed an unbridgeable gulf. We were strangers to each other. Patra remained an inflexible Marxist. He was not prepared to consider other opinions. It was like talking to a brick wall. But all his good qualities were still there. His willpower, his self-sacrifice, his compassion. It struck her again that their relationship would never have worked. He left without ever meeting his daughter, Nina. From Sao Paulo, Patra wrote a letter explaining that he had changed his mind about coming to Germany, having concluded the revolution would never happen in Europe. In the GDR, too, middle-class values prevail. In 1977, 11 years later, a package for Ursula arrived from Brazil, a cloth parcel stitched with care. I weighed it in my hand. The parcel was not heavy. While I was cutting the seams with the scissors, I saw Johann in front of me, sewing it slowly and carefully with a thick needle and coarse thread. The memory brought sadness and pain. A narrow cardboard box lined with wood shavings and a Brazilian newspaper. What had he sent me? She removed the last wrappings of tissue paper, and the circular china disc lay in the palm of her hand. The porcelain seller's gong. A month later, she learned that Johann Patra was dead. Ursula outlived all her lovers. Len Burton was never fully comfortable living in East Germany and was prone to bouts of depression. Ursula had recruited him into intelligence, trained him, and married him. He had always been the junior partner, providing solidity and care, but little of the excitement or romance of her earlier loves. Len sometimes talked of returning to the UK, but he never did. The orphan from Barking never stopped loving the girl he had met, holding a bag of oranges outside a Swiss supermarket. Len died in 1997 at the age of 83. Rudolf Hamburger died in Dresden in 1980. 10 years later, he was posthumously rehabilitated by Moscow. His memoir of the Gulag, 10 Years in the Camps, was published in 2013 and described by one critic as uplifting in its irrepressible hope for humanity. She had loved Rudy for his kindness, Patra for his revolutionary strength, and Len for his long, sweet comradeship. But she had found the love of her life in 1931, screeching through Shanghai on the back of a fast motorbike. The framed photograph of Richard Sorge hung on Ursula's study wall for the rest of her life. "She was in love with Sorge," said her son Michael. "She was always in love with him." The communists showered Ursula with honours and acclaim. In 1969, a second Order of the Red Banner followed the first, received in the Kremlin in 1937. She was awarded the National Prize of East Germany, the Order of Karl Marx, the Patriotic Order of Merit, and the Jubilee Medal. In 1977, she published an autobiography, Sonia's Report, revealing that the famous writer had been a prolific spy. Her children were astonished to discover their mother's past. It was an instant bestseller. The book was written under Stasi control. The prudish state censors told her to remove the parts relating to her unconventional love life. She refused. "I have no reason to feel ashamed on moral or ethical grounds. Shame on you for demanding such an omission." Even so, the final book was partly a work of communist propaganda. The original, unexpurgated version, including what the state did not want her to reveal, is in the Stasi archives. At the age of 84, she was permitted to travel to Britain to publicise her memoirs. Some MPs called for her arrest, but the Attorney General ruled against prosecution. An embarrassing trial was the last thing MI5 wanted. Ursula's communist faith mellowed, adjusted, and gently dissipated, but it never evaporated. Her faith was profoundly shaken by discovering the truth about Stalin's Great Purge, but she defended her past. "I had not worked those 20 years with Stalin in mind." Her enemy, she insisted, was always fascism. "For that reason, I hold my head up high." Yet she was too much of a realist to pretend that Soviet communism truly reflected the ideals she had espoused as a teenager. The crushing of the Hungarian revolt against Moscow in 1956, the building of the Berlin Wall in 1961, ostensibly to keep fascists out of East Germany, but in reality to prevent its citizens from escaping. The crushing of the Prague Spring in 1968, when Soviet tanks rolled into Czechoslovakia to destroy the fledgling reform movement. Ursula witnessed these events with mounting anxiety. In the 1970s, she had come to the realization, in her words, that what we thought was socialism was fatally flawed. Looking back over her life, she accepted she had been naive. In old age, she condemned the dogmatism within the party, which increased with the years, the exaggeration of our achievements and the covering up of our faults, the isolation of the Politburo from the people. She felt bitterness against the party leaders who could manipulate me and mislead me, and wondered if she should have distanced herself from the decaying East German regime. She admitted she had knuckled under to what I knew was wrong and taken advantage of the opportunities offered by the state. "I fought the ills that were known to me, but only to the extent that would permit me to keep my party membership and to write further books." But even as communism crumbled in the late 1980s, her core left-wing values remained unchanged. "I still believed that a better socialism could be achieved. With glasnost and perestroika, with more democracy instead of dictatorship and absolute power, with realistic economic measures. The fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 came as both a shock and a relief. "You cannot divide a nation forever by a wall," she wrote. On the 18th of October 1989, as the old leadership of the GDR was swept away, the 82-year-old Ursula addressed a huge rally in Berlin's Lustgarten and predicted a new era of reformed communism. "My speech is about loss of trust in the party," she said, her words interrupted by bursts of applause. "I have to say to you, after the changes that are now happening, go and become part of the party. Work in it. Change the future. Work as clean socialists. I have courage. I am optimistic because I know it will happen." It didn't, leaving Ursula disillusioned for the first time in her life. In a last interview, she was asked how she felt about German reunification and the collapse of communism. "It does not change my own view of how the world should be," she said. "But it does create in me a certain hopelessness, which I have never had before." Ursula Kaczynski was not a feminist. She had no interest in the role or rights of women in the wider world. Like other independent-minded women of her time, she had entered a male-dominated profession and excelled at it, using every possible advantage that her gender gave her. She was impelled by ideology, certainly, but hers was not the sort of communism adopted over sherry in warm Cambridge common rooms by faddish middle-class English undergraduates in the 1930s. Hers was a faith born of painful personal experience. The savage inequalities of Weimar, the horrors of Nazism, and a world that left dead babies lying in the streets. She was ambitious, romantic, risk-addicted, occasionally selfish, huge-hearted, and tough as only someone who had lived through the worst of 20th century history could be. She was never betrayed. Dozens of people in Germany, China, Poland, Switzerland, and the UK had ample opportunity to expose Ursula and bring her life and espionage to a swift and unpleasant end. None, save Ollo, ever did. For a die-hard communist, she was exceptionally good fun, stylish and warm. She had a gift for friendship, an ability to inspire enduring loyalty, and a willingness to listen and support people whose opinions were radically different from her own. As a revolutionary, she was surprisingly open-minded. She knew how to love and how to be loved. Like all great survivors, she was fantastically lucky. Ursula Kaczynski died on the 7th of July 2000 at the age of 93. A few weeks later, at a ceremony marking the 55th anniversary of victory in the Second World War, Russia's President Vladimir Putin signed a decree proclaiming Ursula a super agent of military intelligence and awarding her the Order of Friendship. Ursula Kaczynski lived long, as the porcelain mender had predicted. She was 10 years old when the Bolshevik Revolution took place, and 82 when the Berlin Wall came down. Her life spanned the whole of communism, from its tumultuous beginnings to its cataclysmic downfall. She embraced that ideology with the unqualified fervour of youth, and saw it die from the disappointed perspective of extreme old age. She spent her adult life fighting for something she believed to be right, and died knowing that much of it had been wrong. But she still looked back with satisfaction. She had fought Nazism, loved well, raised a family, written a small library of good books, and helped the Soviet Union keep nuclear pace with the West, ensuring a fragile peace. She lived several whole lives in one very long one. A woman of multiple names, numerous roles, and many disguises. But even in oldest age, her unconscious reminded her that she was still, and always had been, a spy. "A nightmare haunts my sleep. The enemy is at my heels, and I have no time to destroy the information." Afterword. the lives of others. Klaus Fuchs was released after 9 years in prison and flew directly to East Germany. Greta Kielsen, a communist